This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Hello, everyone. We're so glad you could join us today here on the Indie Book Publishing line, courtesy of Balboa Press. We have a very interesting book to talk about today. The name of the book is Speak Your Truth: How You Can Recover from Lupus. The author of that is Denise Dorfman, and she joins us from her home in Virginia today. Hello, Denise. How are you today?
I'm okay. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Terrific. Well, before we get started here, Denise, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was diagnosed with lupus at age 30 after suffering from mental illness and seizures for about 14 years. I've just been working in the corporate world all my life having this disease, this lupus for about 18 years, and I had discovered self-help and then metaphysics, and I learned that affirmations and taking care of yourself were the answer to recovering from lupus. And I learned that the probable mental cause of lupus was a refusal to stand up for oneself. So after a few years of doing affirmations, my doctor confirmed what I had already known, that I had no active disease and had had it for several years. I ended up changing my health attitude towards health and disease in general, and I believe that anyone can recover from lupus by doing what I did, no matter how long they've had the disease or how severe it is.
Denise, let's back up just one step. Tell us a little bit about lupus for those who are listening today that may not know a great deal. We probably all heard the name lupus, but tell us a little bit about lupus.
Well, lupus is an autoimmune disease where the immune system attacks itself. It kind of gets confused. It doesn't know the difference between an antibody and an antigen. You end up, with sicknesses. You end up kind of getting sick and feeling tired all the time. When the person first has symptoms, they have joint pain because the inflammatory response kicks in. For me especially, I had a hard time moving my fingers and they hurt. Often the white blood count and the red blood count will be low, and the platelet count will be low. Your lab work is very abnormal, and that's usually you get referred to a rheumatologist when you're diagnosed, and it takes a while to be diagnosed with lupus.
So you started to just kind of briefly give us an idea of what's in your book and some of your ideas. I'm going to take it, as you mentioned, it's alternative kind of thoughts of how to treat lupus. How traditionally does medicine doctors treat people with lupus?
Well, there's unfortunately there's no cure for lupus, and there's not a whole lot they can do. They can give you, anti-inflammatory medications and steroids, such as Plaquenil and prednisone, I believe that those are the only medicines that I know of that are commonly used in treating lupus. And it's a lot of monitoring, and I know my rheumatologist said I should exercise and get plenty of rest, because you really need to take care of yourself very well if you have lupus.
So what led you to this idea, Denise, and I'm trying to find a way to describe it. You were doing it so well earlier, where you believe there was a different way. What light went off, so to speak, that you went, maybe this is a way that, at least for me, I can treat my lupus?
Well, I learned about the whole mind and body connection through Louise Hay and her book, You Can Heal Your Life. And she believed that, or believes that every person creates every illness in their body. And the, that the same mind that creates illness can create wellness. So when I read her book, I realized that it just kind of resonated with me. And I said, you know, yes, these ideas sound right. And I just had an intuitive feeling that they just felt right. And so I just started applying her her philosophies and her ideas. She feels that, you know, affirmations can combat illness, and you can recover from even lupus. She believed that lupus was a disease of kind of a refusing to stand up for yourself, and like better to die than to stand up for yourself. So, and I discovered that in my childhood that I never did stand up for myself, and I was always the child that was picked on, and even into adulthood I was you know, kind of bullied and not very assertive. And when I started doing the affirmation, the new thought pattern that Louise Hay outlined in her book for lupus, I noticed that I started to respect myself more, and started commanding respect from others. And I started standing up to, for myself, and speaking up for myself, and asking for what I wanted at work, as well as defending myself against anybody that would attack me, or and I noticed, you know, soon after that my symptoms of lupus started to go away, and I started feeling better. And that was when my rheumatologist declared I had no active disease. So and I was feeling very good. He confirmed what I had already pretty much knew, that I had no symptoms and no active disease. So he just told me to just keep doing what you're doing, because I was doing so well with it.
Again, the name of the book we're talking about today is Speak Your Truth, How You Can Recover from Lupus. The author is Denise Dorfman, and she joins us today on the Balboa Press Line. So, Denise, is your book, kind of documenting what you went through? Describe what people are going to find as they go through the pages in your book.
Yes, it does describe what I went through and document it. And it also tells you how to kind of apply these principles that I learned in your own life, saying these affirmations in front of the mirror, and, you know, saying them before you go to bed at night, and so that it, you know, you go into your subconscious mind, just learning to stand up for yourself, how you can, you know, really manifest wellness in your life and feel better. I also go into how to take care of yourself, the kind of diet that's good for people suffering from lupus, an anti-inflammatory diet, as well as good health care practices, you know, to keep yourself healthy and well.
So is this something that a person would need to do, Denise, on a regular basis, say like taking medication? I mean, that with the affirmations and this mental aspect of what you're describing, is that a daily routine?
Yes, it's pretty much when you get up in the morning, you know, say these affirmations in the mirror, and say the affirmation before you go to bed at night, and just keep repeating it over and over again, and start standing up for yourself more, and start, you know, kind of acting on these, kind of acting it out and doing these affirmations. And you'll find, you know, people that have a hard time standing up for themselves and being assertive, they'll find how easy it is to stand up for yourself. But, you know, as soon as you defend yourself, people tend to back down, and and they tend to respect you more. And I think the more you just keep doing that more and more, and eventually you'll find that your symptoms will subside. At least that's what happened with me, and that's how I recovered from lupus.
It sounds like to me, Denise, and I haven't been through obviously what you have, but it sounds like to me maybe the most difficult thing is getting started. Do you give folks some ideas in your book of how to start this process?
You know, it's just a matter of, you know, writing it in the morning, maybe writing it down 10 or 20 times every morning, and kind of in your, you know, at the breakfast table. That's how I got started. I just started writing down the affirmation 10 or 20 times in the morning, and then just kind of repeated it every time I thought of my disease, and every time I felt afraid to stand up for myself, I would just affirm to myself, I speak up for myself freely and easily, I claim my power, I love and approve of myself, I am free and safe. And I just, you know, whenever I thought of, you know, whenever I felt bad or whenever I felt afraid to stand up for myself, I would just, and the affirmation is calming and really helped me to have the courage to just start standing up for myself.
So I'm curious, what did your doctor say when you went back? Your lupus seemed to be in remission, if that's the correct word for lupus.
Yeah.
What did the doc say?
Well, he just was amazed, and he said, you know, I wish I could take credit for this, but I can't, you know, because I you know, all I did was prescribe Plaquenil for you and examine you. And he said, you're really one of my success stories, and just keep on doing what you're doing. It was amazed, and he just said, you've had no active disease, you know, for several years now. So he was really amazed, but he didn't really know what happened because I never really told him.
Again, the name of the book we're talking about today is Speak Your Truth, How You Can Recover from Lupus. The author is Denise Dorfman. Denise, how difficult was it to write a book? I mean, this has to be really personal for you. How difficult was it to sit down and write this thing in a book?
Well, you know, it did take some getting over the fear because you're kind of, you know, I was kind of putting myself out there kind of vulnerable, you know, opening myself up. But I just sat down and just, you know, sat down on my laptop and started writing. And that's what a friend of mine wrote a book as well. And she just said, just start writing. Just sit down, start writing, and before I knew it, I had a 100-page book, and I did a lot of revisions and editing, and I don't know. I think as I was writing, I kind of got over the fear of putting myself out there.
So what is your hope, Denise? What is it that you're hoping when people pick up a copy of Speak Your Truth, How You Can Recover from Lupus? What is it that you're hoping that they come away with?
I really hope that they will, you know, believe that it is possible to recover from lupus through affirmations, and that it does not matter how severe your illness or how long you've lived with it. You can recover or at least get better through affirmations and through the way you live and the way you take care of yourself. And I really want as many people to know about this as possible because, you know, people really suffer with this disease. People are hospitalized every few months with, you know, either kidney disease, you know, which is another symptom of lupus, or they, you know, they have to stop working and they go on disability because they can't work and they feel they don't feel productive. They don't feel like they contribute, and it's just such a insidious disease, you know, and it can really upset your life. And if I can, you know, if I can cause, you know, if I can help people to lead more productive and happier lives, and to get well through affirmations, I'll feel like that's kind of the goal of the book, is to help as many people suffering from lupus as possible.
Again, the name of the book is Speak Your Truth, How You Can Recover from Lupus, written by Denise Dorfman. She is with us today on the Balboa Press Line. Denise, I know the book's only been out, the beginning of May. Tell us where folks can go and learn more, maybe find a copy of your book.
You can actually go on Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com. It's also available in bookstores, as you know, Barnes and Noble bookstores, and you can. Those are the main venues where you would go to find my book.
Now, if folks wanted to learn more about you, Denise, do you have a website, a blog, Facebook, someplace people could go and learn more about you?
Yes, I have a blog on WordPress, and I have a Facebook page. You can like my Facebook page. The Facebook page is called Speak Your Truth, and Denise Dorfman is I'm the author, and you can also follow me on Twitter. My handle is Denise799 on Twitter, and. You can follow me and like my Facebook page.
Well, it sounds like an interesting book. I think especially helpful for the people who are facing lupus in their life. Again, the name of the book we've been talking about today, Speak Your Truth, How You Can Recover from Lupus. The author is Denise Dorfman. Denise, thank you so much for being with us today, and good luck with your book.
Thank you so much for having me. All right.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everybody. This is Pete Six of Beatles and Beyond. Why don't we all come together and hear some of the tracks off the latest Beatles release on this radio station? Yes, why don't you look up the schedules on this radio station and join me and Beatles listeners everywhere to hear the latest releases from the Beatles on Beatles and Beyond with Pete Dix.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The Soul Comes First, and the author is Brian Balke. And Brian joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Trafford Publishing. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Steve.
Great to have you with us. This is going to be a great discussion of a couple of different challenging views that you present. One, that the earth, the creation, was here to literally help heal the angels. And then you have, of course, man coming along, which often is portrayed, you know, guilt-ridden, fallen, and needs to be rescued. And, of course, Christ plays a part in that. But you see Christ playing an even greater role with not only man, but with the angels. So this book, The Soul Comes First, let's talk about how it came about, Brian, a little bit about your background and how the book kind of came into being.
Yeah, Steve, this is a very significant question to me, because obviously I'm not a biblical scholar, and I'm not somebody that honestly references the Bible every single day of my life. I have a very strong sense of Jesus and his mission and what it means to be a Christian, and I live that as much as I can. But, you know, people are going to ask, why would we want to read this book by a scientist and a computer programmer? And part of that might be that, you know, you are a scientist or an engineer who has this sense of faith and the connection to the principles of loving that Jesus talks about. And so you'd like to have some explanation as to why it's so complicated and so difficult if God is really loving. But the other aspect of things for me has to relate to my journey of faith, which was a tumultuous one, a very difficult one in some sense. I was raised in a tradition that didn't emphasize a personal guilt as defining our relationship with God. And I remember when I would go to church as a child, looking up at the cross and just having this terrible sense of anger emanating from it. And it was kind of intuitively obvious to me in those early years that this wasn't a very good way of encouraging people. I seem to be just something disjointed and disconnected about that. And I certainly appreciated very much the role of women in my life and how they quietly kind of went about just making things happen while the men were kind of strutting around on the stage and acting real important. And that quiet kind of nurturing seemed to me to be very important. So because of this disconnect, I actually wandered away, and I obviously became a scientist, and science has been teaching us for quite some time now that religion is basically just foolishness and it's self-delusion at some level. That's a very popular view in the sciences at this point. And I subscribed to that for a long time. And it wasn't until I kind of came into my spirituality in my 40s and under very difficult circumstances that I really began to reach out and try to understand spiritual experience on its own merits, not from the perspective of a scientist trying to analyze it, but just in its own merits. And I went into a Catholic church, and there was this large cross in this one particular church, a very beautiful church, a lot of wood, a lot of natural tones to it. And I was just struck by this image of Jesus kind of hanging in space and pain. And what happened to me was that my hand went to my heart, and I just held it out to him. I said, "Heal yourself." And that established this kind of a very, very unexpected relationship and a sense of connection to a work which I perceive is going on in the world right now. And I began to have a series of lucid dreams, very powerful lucid dreams, that had to do with a sense of this energy moving into the world which is seeking to heal it of the pain that it's in right now. And these are things like, you know, dreams about an Aborigine in the South Pacific who presented himself to me in a dream one night and said, you know, "Help me," you know, just with the sense of the trauma that the life in that region, whether it's the whales and the birds or the creatures of the land, and a sense of this great energy coming through my heart from the other side of this connection that was established when I held it out to Jesus on the cross. And I've had other experiences similar to that. And so what I'm writing from and the point that I'm writing from is one of just this sense of connection to this process and awareness of this process. And I want people to understand and share this perception that I have, which is a very beautiful and heartening one, which is that there's just an enormous amount of power standing behind the conclusion of this process. And that surrendering ourselves to love of each other and to the love of the world around us is the way forward. And it's a very hopeful way for me when it seems like when we look around the world at this point in time that there's a lot of reason to be concerned and afraid.
Well, there's so much hate in the world and there's so much evil, and it's hard to sometimes understand for most Christians or of people of any faith that love is the answer when love seems to be crushed often by those who just want to have greater and greater power. Let's get back to this whole notion of angels. Now, tell us about, well, first of all, what are angels?
Well, in my understanding of things as a physicist, because I did go back and think about some of the physics theories, and I it's surprising to me when you see the Nobel Prizes being awarded, and as a physicist who's studied all this stuff, just how flimsy these theories are. But when I began to have these spiritual experiences, I went back and I looked at the physical theories and said, where are the holes? Where are the unexamined assumptions, things that we've taken for granted that we can get rid of? And in that process, I came across a whole set of theories that, from a philosophical perspective, contain the soul in them, just as a part of the natural order that we exist in. And so from my perspective, angels are ideas, and that part of what happens when we think for a long, hard time about something is we're creating an angel or a thought of some kind. And the angels, in the form of ideas, the pure form of ideas, came from the realm of the Almighty, which is spoken about in Scripture and in some places. But because of this infection that they had, they were put into this place where there's matter, not just pure ideas, not just pure spirit, but there's matter itself. And the angels have political structures and hierarchies just like we do. You know, you've got, like, you know, I'm sitting here in my room in my apartment complex, and that's in Agoura Hills, and that's in, you know, L.A. County, which is in California, and you have this whole hierarchy. Well, angels have a similar kind of a hierarchy to them, which is there's very simple thoughts like I'm hungry or this is blue or something along those lines. And these ideas relate and mix together, and they become more and more complex things, and ultimately you achieve very high levels of abstraction or organization, which are the archangels in our own domain. There's more complicated things out in the realm of the Almighty. But so angels are personalities, pure personality. They're ideas, and they have their own evolutionary process, which is very interesting and beautiful in its own way.
So the Bible, as you put it, records the divine effort to prepare human nature for a privileged role in healing the wound of selfishness. Obviously, selfishness leads to all the problems in the world for the most part. I mean, it doesn't lead to all diseases, but for the way man treats man. How does healing come about for us?
Well, there's, you know, one of the most powerful events in recent history or in the recent news for me involved this group of Amish girls that were trapped in their schoolhouse with a man who had come in with a gun. This is obviously very painful. And what happened was that he told them that he was going to kill them. And what happened was that the eldest girl stepped forward and said, well, these young ones haven't been here as long as me, so if you're going to kill somebody, kill me. And he did. And what I see in that moment is she conquered his evil in that moment. And this is what happened with Christ on the cross, which is that he's hanging up there, and he's been beaten and whipped and nailed to this tree, and he's dying slowly. And he says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And so he received the violence and the selfishness, and what he did was he gave back compassion. And in that process, he infected those that were hurting him with his compassion. You know, they in some sense they thrust their spirits into him, and they said, you know, we're going to destroy you, we're going to take this love from you, we're going to do whatever we want to with it. But what happened was that he stayed strong in that moment, and he said, I'm going to love you anyways, even though you're doing this to me. And because of that, when they thrust their spirits into him, they couldn't disentangle themselves from him. And so this great work of compassion, of the injection of compassion into the human spirit has been going on for a long time. And I see that manifesting in this girl. You know, what she's doing is she's showing compassion for her friends, for her sisters in this place. She's showing compassion for this man in his pain. And that's what the Amish did after he killed himself. They went out to his family and they brought them food and gave them support. They gave them compassion. They recognized that they had been trapped with this evil. You know, and one of the things that what the elders said when they were preparing the bodies for burial is, we must not think evil of this man. You know, and so there's this process, and it's hard for us to recognize this is going on, because the initial conditions were really, really, really bad. Basically, what's recorded, the way they interpret Revelation is that, you know, when the seven seals are broken, these aren't seven human personalities coming to the world. These aren't things, events happening to people. What these are is that these are principles of selfishness. And John, you know, they come into his brain and he has to interpret these principles in terms that he can relate to other people. And so he comes up with these images of people and things like that. But what's happening is he's really talking about selfishness being given possession of the earth, which places us in really, really difficult circumstances to begin with. And there's a lot of people who feel that selfishness is still holding sway and still in charge of the world. But if you look at the history of humanity, we have a lot of concepts and tools at this point in time that the ancients didn't have for negotiating and about these kinds of problems, and for bringing pressure and for resisting selfishness when it's imposed upon us. You know, we have, you even just look at the last century. It started off with the Industrial Revolution, the terrible industrial hygiene conditions that you had in, for example, New York City, with people that were working in factories exposed to poisons all the time. They were living 20 people in an apartment, and that were quite often were not properly sealed. They were exposed to the elements or anything like that. And what happened was that Christian people, to a certain degree, although there were others, but in this nation primarily Christian people, stood forward and said, you can't do this to people. You know, you have to treat them better than this. And so while it is difficult, and while we tend to focus on the pain and the hurt itself, which means the world, I think that if you look at the long history and the long progression, that there has been this great rising up in the sense of people doing for others, not because of anything that comes to them, like, you know, Mother Jones going out and finding the children in the coal mines and marching them to Washington to say, look what's happening to our children. How can we let this happen to them? There was no reason that she had to do this. She didn't make any money doing it. But people do these kinds of things. Martin Luther King Jr., you know, in our own time, you might say, well, you know, he was assassinated, but, you know, what he said just before his assassination was that, you know, I have been to the mountain and I have seen the promised land, and I may not get there with you, but you will see the promised land. And we have, you know, Barack Obama as president at this point in time. And I think that what he, you know, and what he also said in that moment was that he was not afraid any longer. He just wasn't afraid any longer. And so I think that there's this work which is done in spirit, and we tend to focus on the physical aspects and the physical misery, but there's this great work done in spirit and this enormous power in these personalities. And even when they're beaten back and forced out of the world, that spirit still resides among us, and it inspires people and it gives them strength to stand up against selfishness and to work to create better conditions, not just for themselves, but for other people.
Well, in that hope is this view of humanity that often is looked at flawed, but you see humanity is not necessarily just the source of evil in the world, but actually, as you just put it, the best hope for its healing. So we agree. We want to have hope for the future, and even though there's so much just traumatic and tragic and overwhelming things that are going on in the world right now, it's great to talk with someone who sees hope and sees it in humanity. Brian Balke, he is the author of The Soul Comes First. Brian, what's the best way to get your book?
You can get it at Trafford at www.trafford.com. It's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and it can be ordered from your bookseller. It's available in ebook format as well as hard copy.
Thank you so much for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you for having me, Steve, and you have a wonderful day and a wonderful life.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Trafford Publishing.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
My hairstylist is Jewish. I am Shitza, and we are sisters. And the author is Shannon Callahan. And Shannon joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Archway Publishing. Hello, Shannon.
Hi there, Steve. How are you?
Well, right away, we've got to ask you about this word in your title, Shitza.
Shitza. That is a Yiddish word, and it means a non-Jewish woman or girl.
So your hairstylist is Jewish. You're not, and your sisters. What's that title mean? There's a lot of symbolism in here.
There is a lot of symbolism, and it sounds like an oxymoron, but in fact it is truth, because as you read through the book, although I started from a Catholic background and she is Jewish and we both retain our faith, we came together when I was quite ill, and I was unable to leave the house, and because women need to have nice hair to feel good, she started doing my hair, and one thing led to another, and we started discussing life issues and challenges, and we talked about raising children and being moms, and then we went to deeper levels of sharing our faith life, where we came from, and over time we became so close that we were like sisters, and we're still that close right now, and it was an amazing experience for me, because it really did open my mind to bigger realms of truth, and I was always looking for more truth and for anybody to give me some advice or help, because I was so ill, and it was hard to keep confident or positive at that time, and she would come along, and she was very loving and kind, and it got me through a very, very dark period, and I grew from it, and I distilled all the pain and the things that were difficult about it and put it into a format which was humorous, because I've always felt that humor is a great equalizer, and it's the best way to bring down barriers between people. When you speak in humor, it's a universal language, and it unifies people, and that's why I chose to use that format to write this book.
Well, women always struggle with their hair. What is it with hair? Why is that such a challenge for women? Is it because of some of the folks like Farrah Fawcett and others who just seem to have perfect hair?
I don't know where it started or when it started, but it's been going on for a long time. If you look at the Bible, women were primping and doing things back then, and you look at Queen Esther, and she got to primp before she went before the king. So I know it's been going on for a long time, and I go to hair salons, and women are always there getting their hair styled in this way or that, or getting a different cut. And I think it's part of one's image, and I believe also that when your self-image exteriorly looks good, you can feel more confident inside, because you don't have to think about it. And hair is so visible. It's on your head, it's right there, and people see it, and people's hair, I mean, if you put on a funny wig, it changes people's perception of who you are, and for some reason or other, it's a very powerful visual. I can't explain why, but that's just the way things are.
Well, and you, you know, you look at little girls. I look at my daughters when they were little, and of course I have a granddaughter that lives near me, and she's got this beautiful long hair, you know, all the waves and curls, and then women hit puberty, or these young girls hit puberty, and it, hair becomes, oh my goodness, what is it? What happens with adolescence?
It's terrible. It for many women, it changes texture, and then it becomes a different set of issues because what you were used to, which didn't even concern you, changes, and then you have this issue because you're going through adolescence and you're becoming a grown-up, and you have to step up to the plate, and now you have this concern that you never had before. So I think that's what the evolution of the hair through adolescence is. It's this change that changes with oneself, and to get it into perspective and make it so it's not an issue, you start to try to groom it.
So you take us back to those early days when you were battling it.
Yes, I start from childhood, and I talk about how my hair was just fine when I was young, and then I speak about how I had actually chopped it all off because I was a tomboy and I liked to explore, and my mom was on the telephone and she was going to cut my hair, and I didn't have time for her to be on that phone call, so I decided to take it into my own hands, and I chopped off my hair and ended up having hair that looked like my little brother's. And so back then when it was easy, it wasn't even a concern, and then you hit adolescence, which is such a confusing time for everyone, no matter if you're male or female, and then that became an issue, and it just added to my insecurity. I was deeply insecure, and that added more to it because it was something I couldn't control, and it was changing, and I couldn't make sense of it, and I struggled with it for decades.
Well, and you don't want to be like mom, because mom's hairstyle always looks so old and frumpy, right?
That's exactly right. In fact, in the book, I mentioned how when I was growing up, moms all had a certain way that they did their hair, and I called it the Betty Crocker hairstyle. And they, according to my friends, we look at our mother's pictures and we feel like we look younger now than when our mothers were younger than we are because of their hairstyle. And I notice more and more women are growing their hair longer now, and everybody wants to hold on to youth, and it's hard to admit the passage from the 20s into the 30s and the 30s into the 40s and so on. And hair and hairstyles dictate a lot of the different changes through your life and your maturation.
Well, the book, though, seems to take a sharp turn. I don't know which way it's going, right or left or backwards. Because you start talking about men, you know, and their preferences, male preferences. Give us a little insight in your thinking.
Well, growing up in a household where I had a brother who was very verbal about what he thought about women and their bodies, and with the media being so frank about what they think is acceptable, and then looking and searching to try to be accepted in society or in my little sphere of influence, which was in high school, I kept looking for what is that woman that people won't reject, I guess. I think that's what I was after. And why is it that they accept this one and not that one? And so I got into the mindset of thinking about how men think by reading things and through the course of my life just asking questions and finding out why men found this or that attractive and women as well. And so I did a lot of exploration into the differences between the sexes and how they think, and I think it's a fascinating subject because we do think differently and we see things differently, just as every human being sees things differently because we all come from our own experiential knowledge base. And I thought that was important to share. I wrote the book for women, although men have read it and they like it. I did write it for women because I think at my age, being an empty nester, that's really why I wrote the book. I didn't have a career. I chose to be a stay-at-home mom, which was right for me, and I was happy to do it, and I invested all my time in that. But once my children went off, as my friend Susie said, it's like you got fired. And I didn't want to just be Mrs. So-and-so. I wanted something else for my life. I knew I couldn't do that and sustain any level of happiness. So I suppose I continued to look at men and what men and women think. And so I did research, and I kept researching, and I decided to put that into the book because it helps people put a perspective on why culture is the way it is and how it goes down to individuals and what they think. It's their perceptions.
So again, an amusing look, humorous look at reality, because men do look at women and they, you know, you call them, you have a face man, a leg man, a breast man, a bottom man. You know, I mean, they're all, for some reason, that all of us as men, we're a bit strange, aren't we?
No, I think you're wonderful the way you are. You're just different than women, and women are different than men. And I think that's where I was trying to go with the information, is to be able to understand one another. I think it's important to learn the language of another person, and in this respect, it's for women to learn the language of men and vice versa. So I would ask questions, and I would find out about what their male preferences were and why, and I had so many funny comments, and men would never really be out there with why they thought that, but they would weigh in, you know, yes, I'm this, or this is interesting to me. And I thought that was of merit, that I should write that down, and it can be funny.
Well, here you are at this important time in your life, and you've transformed from this insecure girl to a confident woman, as you put it, who happily accepts herself just as she is. So this book has a happy ending.
Oh, my gosh, yes. I love happy endings. I won't watch a movie that doesn't have a happy ending. And I think that our world is filled with bad news and a lot of strife and division, and I wanted to make people laugh. I wanted it to be one of those comic relief moments where you have a relief from all the struggles and whatever's weighing one down, and to be able to laugh again, because when you laugh, it kind of gives you a break from whatever's going on, and then you can reevaluate and come back to a place of balance and to be able to really see things for what they are.
Well, tell us the best way to get your book.
Well, my friends have been ordering my book on Amazon, and it's coming quickly. It's also at Barnes & Noble. I think that people have to order it because it has to be ordered. It's not stocked yet because it was just launched.
Oh, okay.
And I'm not too familiar with how every publishing house works, but in this instance for myself, that I am an unpublished authoress before this. I did write two novels, and they didn't get published. And so I don't really have any kind of format to work with from experience. So I can say that what I've learned is that people order it at Barnes & Noble, and they get it. And people have been getting it on Amazon, and they've been perfectly happy. And I've gotten a lot of good feedback, which has been great. People have been texting and leaving emails and phone calls, and just a lot of women say, gosh, I loved it. I'm so glad you wrote it. It really made me laugh. One woman said that she teared up, because it's not just humor, because life isn't always humorous. And honestly, I think the difference between tragedy and comedy is about a hair's width. It's so fine.
Right.
And I just wanted to take pain and what could have been tragic and turn it into comedy, because we all have something that, you know, is painful or tragic or whatever, and we need to turn it around so we can move forward.
Well, I just Googled my hairstylist is Jewish, and you came right up. So there it is.
That's great.
Shannon Callahan. She is the author we've been listening to, and we appreciate you being with us, Shannon, on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you so much, Steve, for having me, and I hope you have a wonderful day and hope you get a chance to read my book.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Archway Publishing.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.